Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I felt like I just ripped everyone off so bad because they didn't get the best of me. And so my goal is that every single person who've purchased a ticket, they deserve the best of what I do. So the only way I can do that is to look after myself.
That is singer, songwriter, and producer Guy Sebastian. And this is episode 237 of the Osher Ginsburg podcast. And welcome to the Osher Ginsburg podcast. I'm Osher Ginsburg. I'm so happy you're here. Thanks for coming. This is episode 237 with a superstar of Australian music, Guy Sebastian. He's on Twitter and Instagram at Guy Sebastian, GuySebastian. Guy Sebastian is heading out around the country on his then and now a 2018 tour. You can buy tickets right now, GuySebastian.com. He's got a very centralized social media and internet presence, so man, everything's just called Guy Sebastian. It's good. But I guarantee you, look, after this conversation, after what you're about to hear, you'll want to spend an evening with Guy and his band. So make your plans, get a babysitter. If you haven't been to a gig in a long time, go see the Guy Sebastian show. Because once you listen to this, you'll be like, oh, we're friends. I know that guy. I'll go see him. If this is your first episode of the show, welcome. Hi, I'm Osher. I work in TV in Australia. I used to work in radio. I'm about to be a published author. And in Australia, sometimes I'm on the telly. I count roses a little later in the year, a couple of weeks from now. I'm going to start on the rose counting. I deliver date cards on a show called The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, sometimes Bachelor in Paradise. It's a great gig. I'm very lucky to do it. I'm busy making it at the moment, but you won't see it for a couple more weeks. When I'm not working on telly, though, every Monday for the last 236 Mondays in a row, I've been here in your phone or your iPad or your tablet or your laptop or the back of a seat. If you're on a Qantas or Jetstar plane, I've been here every Monday having a conversation that you get to be a part of with someone that you may know or someone that you may not know. But each week, I guarantee that you'll hear something that'll resonate, and I guarantee you'll hear something you need to hear. I guarantee it. And definitely, I guarantee you'll hear something that will make today a little better than yesterday. You got my word on that guarantee. You can email me. Email me if I've failed you, all right? Because that's really it about making today better than yesterday. That is what it is about to be a human. Otherwise, we'd all still be chasing antelopes around the savannah, wouldn't we? We just want to make today a little better than yesterday as human beings. Sometimes we forget that we have that capacity. I just wanted to remind you, something that shat you today, you can do something about it. If you can't do something about it, you can do something about how you feel about it. That's our superpower as people. It's great. I have to work very hard to remind myself of that on a daily basis, but it's still a superpower. Thank you very much to everybody that reached out and spread the word about the Todd Sampson episode. What an epic it was. He's incredible. Body Hack did incredibly on Thursday night. Check it out again on this Thursday. It's an amazing show. He's an incredible guy. Well worth a second listen if you haven't listened to it twice. It is, and so many people shared that show, and it is a massive help when you share this podcast. Just on the app you're listening to this on, just hit share and text it out to someone. You could screenshot it. You could share it on Instagram. You could put it out on Facebook. All the time at dinner, people ask me what a podcast is. At a dinner, I'll pick up their phone. I'll download a podcast app. I'll show them how to download podcasts and hand the phone back and go, there you go. I just changed your life. Whatever works for you. Not my podcast, obviously. I download other people's podcasts. Whatever works for you, I'd really appreciate it if you could share this show because, like, honestly, if I think about it, if everyone listening told another person and they all started listening, then I'd double my download numbers. And, you know, that's not going to happen, but it'd be amazing. But the fact is that the more downloads that you have, the better guests that you get access to, particularly with high profile guests who have very limited calendars and they want to be sure they use their time wisely. And that means that the better shows you get to hear and the people that you recommend of the show to will get to hear better shows. And they'll go, damn, that's a good podcast you put me on to. And you go, yeah, I know. Thank you so much. Unreal. So you win in two separate ways. If you do want to support the show in a more significant way, you can always throw a few shekels our way. Patreon.com/Osher. Thank you very much to the people that threw some bucks our way this week. Some people put $1. Some people put $5. Whatever you can, it would really, really help. Podcasts are free to listen to, but they are not free to make. I need to pay Andy, my audio producer, and Hayley, my show producer, I have to pay them. So every single bit helps for me to get you the shows each and every Monday. Because I can promise you that a man as busy as Guy Sebastian doesn't just show up to your house on a whim. It takes Olympic level calendar coordination. And Hayley, my producer, is a gun at that. So thank you for helping me help Hayley pay her rent. Help Hayley pay her rent. Hayley. You can always email me, sendosheremail@gmail.com. Thanks to everybody that sent in a receipt of the book. You can pre-order the book right now through the bio in my Instagram, link in my Instagram bio. I'm working hard to get you the special thank you gifts that I promised. I get a couple done every day. It does take a little time to send those out. So thank you very much for your patience. They are coming. They are coming. Cheers for all the podsies this week. A podsy is a picture of what you're looking at when you're listening to my voice right now. You are probably listening to this on a device that takes a photograph, unless it's the back of an aeroplane seat. Then I'd be very surprised if it takes a photograph. But other than that, you're probably listening to this on a device that takes a photograph. So just shoot a photo of what it is you're looking at and email it to me or tag me. sendosheremail@gmail.com or put it in Instagram or whatever. We get to enjoy this incredible world together. When you listen to the podcast, as you take me around on your adventures, it's exciting. I love sharing that stuff. Thanks to everybody that reached out about last week's show and also the stuff I talked about before the interview with Todd. Because if this is your first show, you're kind of wondering, or you're probably listening. You're listening because Guy Sebastian's here. And you might be listening because I kind of might remind you of maybe a dark-haired version of the bloke that helped find him on Australian Idol. Maybe there's something familiar there, but you can't figure it out. But what you might know about me is that I, like many, many people in the world, I have a different brain. I have a brain that over my life has been prone to such things as generalized anxiety, social phobia, PTSD, OCD, even a brief and terrifying adventure into the world of psychosis, which I do not recommend at all. So each week, I'm feeling a lot better now. I work hard to try and feel better, and I work out every day to stay better. But each week I like to talk about what's going on with me in the hope that the more frank and not so scary conversations around mental illness that are heard in our community, the more that they will happen and the more people will get help, because life's too short to go through it in pain, and life is too precious and too joyous to go through it gritting your teeth or self-medicating just to get by. So I'm just trying to get people used to the idea of these kind of conversations happening as a matter of fact way, you know, we go, oh, that's just a conversation about what's going on. And nothing but nothing makes me happier than when I get emails, and I get them every day. I do. I get emails about people who've gone to get help after listening to this show. Or they see discussions happening in the Facebook group that we've just started where, you know, people are just supportive and open with each other, and they go out and they take action. They take control of what's happening in their head. I love it. It makes me so happy. A big hello to everyone in the Facebook group, by the way. I'm really enjoying the conversations that we are having there. Just search for the Osher Ginsberg podcast in Facebook, answer a couple of questions and you're in. It's ace. I'm loving it. It's good to be a part of it. So to check in with you this week, I've noticed this is going to be an interesting one. All right. It may resonate with you. I've noticed that I'm knocking over a lot of things. Let me explain. I've always been clumsy. However, I've been knocking over a lot of things, bumping myself, hurting myself on corners, walking into doors, breaking things accidentally, things like that. Now, you might think, so what? You drop stuff. But I know that when I do that sort of thing, it's a sign for me to watch out because it means that I'm not being present. It means that my mind is elsewhere than where I am and not with what I'm doing or who I'm with. When I'm stuck in my head and I'm lost in whatever my brain's making up, it can sometimes be a difficult place for me. And when I'm not present in a situation, not plugged into the facts of the reality that I'm in, I can invent all kinds of reasons for things happening or not happening, reasons why people are being the way they are. And that's not fair on anyone involved. It could be something as simple as washing a glass, all right? Taking it out of the soapy water, going to rinse it, and then knocking it on the edge of the sink. So you might think, so what? But it's the manual dexterity equivalent of a running over the bumpy things in the middle of the road that go ka-dunk, ka-dunk under your car and your passenger goes, hey, dude, and you go, oh, sorry, shit. The part between the lanes, right? Because it means that I'm not paying attention to where I am in space, where the objects that I'm holding start and finish. And that is a sign for me that my mind's being busy, right? Furiously thinking about 17 things at once, most of them things in the future, most of them problems, really scary ones that I'm imagining, and solutions to the problems that I'm then imagining. And then what could possibly go wrong if I don't get those imaginary solutions to the imaginary problems started right now? None of those things are actually happening. However, it takes up an enormous amount of mental bandwidth, and ultimately it leaves me feeling disconnected because it's quite clear to the people that I'm with that my mind is elsewhere. And that's not a great feeling for anyone that's spending time with me. And now, I know it sounds like a lot to read into me being clumsy, but I had to sit down and really think about it because it has been increasing in the last couple of days, weeks. I had to think about, why am I bumping stuff? Why am I dropping things? Why am I breaking things more than I usually do this week? Anyway, and that's the answer I came to. This week, I'm going to try and take extra care to be in the room, concentrating on my spatial awareness when I'm moving myself and things from one place to another. Because if I do that, then I'll be more present. I'll be in the room and I won't be in an imaginary future full of worry and really creative solutions that I'm trying to think of to those worries. Or I can do all that just by paying attention while I do the dishes. Not a bad solution, is it? Also, the dishes get done. Which I love to do. I find doing the dishes very calming. I put on classical music and do the dishes. It's really nice. It's a nice way to end my night. Does that resonate with you? Does that make sense? What have you tried that works if you've noticed something similar? I'd love to know your thoughts. You can drop me a note in the Facebook group, actually. Or you can email me, sandosheremail@gmail.com. That's to give you an idea. That's kind of what the book's about, to be honest. You can pre-order the book in the link in my Instagram bio. But if you do, email me the receipt and I'll send you a little something to say thanks. So look, now that you're settled in, now that you're here, now that we're, 10 minutes, 12 minutes in and you're definitely on the road on your commute or you're well into the work you're doing around the house or you're committed to the workout you've begun, let's get to it. Let's get to my guest today, which I am so, so happy about. Guy Sebastian is a singer, songwriter, and producer from Sydney, Australia. He is on Instagram and Twitter at Guy Sebastian, GuySebastian. Guy Sebastian is the first winner of Australian Idol from back in 2003. He and I have known each other for most of our careers. We've had interviews along the way, sure, when he would come into Channel V or he'd pop in on the radio. But he and I have never spoken like we speak today. We've spoken like this before, but just never on a microphone. All right. He and I, we spent a lot of time with each other and we've connected on, over the years. But we've never spoken like we speak today. Guy Sebastian has an incredible voice and he is a very, very successful recording artist in Australia because he works harder than almost anyone. But you're going to hear a lot more about Guy Sebastian today. Because along the way, Guy has had his struggles. And in this conversation, he and I unlock a massive catalyst for change that happened with Guy, and it only happened in the last 18 months. To put it simply, daily physical exercise changed his life. I'll let him talk you through it. However, the way he describes how hitting the gym every day has changed the way he works, how he thinks, and how he feels, how it changed so many things outside of the gym, not just with him and his physicality. Well, I related so much because it's been my experience too, and it's been what I've been sharing with you over the last few weeks. Guy is a very deep soul. He's a kind man, and he's a man who feels great empathy and love for his life, for his family, and for those who enjoy his music. He spent a couple of hours in my apartment, and we could have chatted all afternoon. However, I think in this one, we really unlock a few of the keys to what makes Guy Sebastian one of the greatest performers our country has ever seen. He's a complete inspiration to me. After this conversation, I was just left absolutely moved and just full of beans and ready to go. I hope you get the same feeling when this conversation is over that I had when Guy left my house. A feeling of elation and a desire to go and move your body. Guy is touring around the country in the next few weeks. Tickets are available at guysebastian.com. Go check him out. I'm telling you, you got to go. If you've ever seen him live, actually, if you've never seen him live, after this conversation, you'll want to spend a night with him just to go, hey, I know you. I feel like I know you. I heard you on the show and now we're friends. And here I am singing your songs with you. It'll be great. He's a very special human. And it's well worth the time just to go and breathe the same air as him. So please, let him know that you heard him on this show. If it resonates with you, he'll get a kick out of it. And enjoy this long overdue conversation with Guy Sebastian. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here, man.
Pleasure.
I'm glad you're here. It's good to have you in our kitchen.
I love being here. You've got a cracking view. You've made me like a special coffee, very fancy coffee. You weighed the coffee beans.
Yeah, it is. It's all about controlling. It's like life, Guy. Yeah. You control the variables within your control and everything else is, you know, you just have to accept.
Are you fairly meticulous in general?
No, I'm not. No. Not at all. You'll notice my wife did a double take there. Audrey's in the kitchen making breakfast. She nearly fell off her feet. I'm not meticulous at all, no. But when it comes to getting great coffee in the morning,
yeah.
What are the variables I can control? I can control how many coffee grounds go in there. I can control how long I draw the coffee for.
Yeah.
I can control the kind of beans. I can control the grind.
Mm. Probably felt a bit of pressure because I walked in as well and I was immediately talking about how much of a coffee snob I am and that I've got a flash machine at home as well.
Mate, if you're a coffee snob, I'm on board. I'm on board. You've got just been served some breakfast there, so don't hesitate to dig in there.
Oh, that looks really
good. Have a bite. I'm grateful you're here. You know, we've been a big part of each other's lives and careers. We both played. You played an enormous role in my
you
life.
You played a huge part in mine, mate.
Yeah, gosh. And you know, it's really nice to sit down and talk about. But you and I crossed paths and I was really I was quite inspired by the physical transformation that you'd been under.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I came off medication, I was looking for, you know, something to put in the place where the medication was. And I've since undertaken a pretty rigorous, you know, physical training regimen, which I've been really, really enjoying.
Yeah. I've seen the
We cross paths at the gym every now and again.
Every time I see you, you're just that little bit more chiseled.
well, I guess, you know, obviously we're influenced by many things around us, but
having seen you and seen your journey and knowing your mum, your family, knowing the relationship that you and your family have to food. I found it. Mm. I remember early when we first met, we talked a lot about that sort of thing, and it felt very familiar to me. In that, you know, the food equals love is a part of the family it's gathering. You know, and redefining my relationship to food and hunger has been a big part of what I'm doing. Did you find that when you were doing your work on yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was an addiction, really.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. And probably a bit of an obsession as well, because I sort of, you know, I don't think men talk about weight issues very often as well. Like I you know, my background, I guess, is one, I always wanted to get into music. I always wanted to be in the industry in some capacity. And I guess for me, when I first started music, I started at quite a superficial time in the industry. You know, it was all about image, and especially in the pop sphere. It was, you know, you had like your NSYNCs and Backstreet Boys and Britney and Jessica Simpsons and Christina, and everyone was very image focused. And you know, one thing I'm really grateful to, you know, from Idol is it really smashed a lot of stereotypes. And I guess one of those was convenient for me. You know, I came in at a good time where it was kind of the start of where the curve turned, and it became about talent again. You know, it became more focused on the actual gift. But, you know, in saying that, before I auditioned for Idol, I did the whole, you know, demo thing, took it to labels, and the thing that kept coming back was, love your voice, but you don't have the look, and, you know, or you're a bit overweight, but it was generally that you always I didn't have the look. And so I was a bit defeated by it. You know, like I sort of, you know, went back to Adelaide, you know, after doing this trip to Melbourne that I saved up for, and, you know, handing my tracks to these record companies. I came back with, you know, tail between my legs, and thought, well, at the end of the day, I can get better at singing, but I can't change the way I look. So maybe I'll just be a producer or something. And at that stage, I'd just quit uni. And so I guess I was just lacking direction. And then my weight and stuff and my image became the thing that I sort of blamed it on as well. I thought, well, that's holding me back and it's not fair. Like, I can't change the way I look and blah, blah, blah. And so then along came Idol, and I'm even in the auditions, I was there with Jules, who I'm, you know, still with, and I kept saying to her, look how good looking that person is, or look at that person, look how fit they are, or look how good looking they are. They've got the look, I don't have it. What am I doing here? And you know, you've come up and interviewed me at this one point, and then I ended up getting through, and it very much became about the singing voice.
How did that make you feel after? I mean, I had no idea that you'd done that in Melbourne. Let's just paint that picture that we were at the, I don't think it's there anymore, some hotel in Adelaide, Intercontinental or something,
yeah,
like
North Adelaide,
something like that, Adelaide, just above the oval there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big ballroom. Everyone was waiting to go and audition for the judges. It wasn't Judges Day. It was just Producers Day.
Just producers. And it was like a circus.
Yeah, there was. There was a grand piano.
Oh, yes.
There was a grand piano. And I remember I had a three-chip, an old-school three-chip video camera, because we were shooting a behind-the-scenes show for Channel V, and I needed to go and, you know, interview some people, because, like, we have to get content, because we've got to make this behind-the-scenes show as part of our deal, Channel V lending me and James out for Idol. It was like we had a behind-the-scenes show to make, so I had to run around and start filming, interviewing people. And I remember you were sitting with your back to a grand piano, you were enjoying some lunch, and there were like three or four of these super chiseled, mega jawed, abs ahoy, like trapezoidal shaped
dancing
guys on the grand piano, all harmonizing and stuff together. Mm. I remember looking at them going, bloody hell, those guys look like they spend more time in the gym than in, you know, rehearsal studios. Jesus.
Yeah, and it was very daunting for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that, to me, represented the key. They had the keys to get into the industry.
Yeah. And then, you know, I rolled tape and I, you know, I walked up to you and we had a conversation about those guys and that was it. You know, we kept going. So as you went further and further through the process and no one said anything about your image or your weight, what did that do to your self-belief?
Well, I guess it's sort of, you know, it's funny because the first, you only remember the negativity, you know, like my first audition, Marsha said I had the best voice she's heard so far. And Mark said something about, you know, it being a gift. And then Dicko said, yeah, but you look like crap. So I walked away from there going, I look like crap. Like, you know, and I was wearing this op shop jacket and this, you know, I had terrible fashion sense but that to me, that one comment, even though I got through, I went, that's going to be the hurdle, my appearance. That's going to be the thing that stops me again, you know, like, and yeah, I'll get through on my voice, but ultimately that'll be the thing. So even though I was getting through, I still had this thing that, and you know, so after winning, you would think that would give me some level of confidence and all that sort of stuff. But I guess the comments never stopped about weight, and a lot of the times they were positive, to be honest, because I think TV, as everyone says, it adds some pounds to
you. Sure does.
So in public, everyone would comment on my weight every day. I'm talking every day that I was in public, someone would say, and multiple times a day, oh, you're so much skinnier in real life. I thought you'd be a lot bigger. I'd rock up to photo shoots. There was 38 waist jeans. I was a 31, 32. So I think I just looked a lot fatter on TV. So when people said, you're a lot skinnier, I didn't take it as a compliment. I took it as, you know, you look fat on TV. So.
Isn't that funny how our brains can distort and listen to only the thing that reinforces the negative view we have of ourselves.
Our insecurities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a perfect example. Three judges, 1, 2, 3, 2 positive comments, 1 negative comment. Let's be honest, 4 showbiz, because we're making a TV show
exactly.
His job on the show was to be the one.
He was the record company
guy. He was the guy that says the thing to knock the people down a peg. Yeah. That was his role. That was his character. That's the role he was playing.
Absolutely.
And that's where he was coming from when he said it.
And I'm closest to Dicko as well out of that whole process. I just love that guy.
But that's the only thing you remember, you know. That's the thing
that negative
defines us, you know. And it's interesting, like people will say, you're skinny. God, look at you. You're so skinny.
Yeah.
Our brains goes, I must look fat.
Yeah, exactly. What do they actually mean, you know?
Isn't that just wild that until we adjust our personal perceptions of ourselves, it doesn't matter what the input is, we'll find a way to filter it so it fits our perspective.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's also as you get older, you tend to be a little wiser about how you view that relationship, you know, and that was, now when I talk about it, I can see that it was so much more than just appearance. It was a representation of failure for me. So I look back and I go, well, that was the thing that's, you know, stopped me from doing what I thought I was meant to do. So it not only was a physical thing of insecurity and all that, but it also lumped into that was that my appearance and my weight and things like that was the thing that was going to stump me for life. But it you know, I think you sort of grow out of that you know, I never would have thought I'd see myself on a Men's Health cover, you know, back in those days, thinking of myself as a, you know, sort of little chubby, you know, gremlin sort of looking kid.
You always describe yourself like that. Those words, you would describe yourself a lot, I remember.
Yeah. So it was a pretty incredible thing. And a lot of people look at people in the public eye and they think, oh, they must be on some magic supplement or some, you know, some sort of, I don't know, like injecting themselves with some sort of steroid or something. But literally, like, all I've had is protein powder and some creatine that I was given. And it's even harder for you with being a vegan.
No, it's actually really easy, to be honest. Being vegan, it's like you only, you know, and I'm, you know, we I get right into the science of it all because I'm kind of really fascinated with how my body works. And a buddy of mine, Ruben Meerman, who's been on the show a couple of times, wrote a whole book about when you lose weight, where does it go? Do you know?
Yeah, no.
If you lost 10 kilograms, do you know where that 10 kilograms goes?
Yeah, no. No idea.
8.4 kilograms of that, 10 kilograms of fat, I believe it's 8.4, you breathe out. Every exhalation is heavier than every inhalation because you're breathing out carbon dioxide. Yeah. Those carbon atoms used to be fat.
Really?
Yep. You breathe it out.
That's true.
That's where you lose weight. That's how you lose weight. You lose weight. Your lungs is where you lose fat.
You're going to find me on the street later just passed out from hyperventilating.
But
I'm just going,
you've got to get yourself to a point. You've got to get yourself to a point where you are on the floor of the gym. I'll just be down here. I'll be, just give me 10 seconds. I can't stand up right now.
Yeah. But to their credit, when I first started training, you know, my trainers were so they paced it so well that training didn't become this huge thing in my brain that was going to make me feel sick all the time. So they eased me into that. But then when they felt I was ready on a fitness level, they pushed me to this point where now I almost look at people in the gym and I think, come on, man, like, dude, you can, like, you could do what you're doing in 15 minutes, you know, but you're taking 2 hours because you're on Insta between sets and you're only doing weights or whatever. Now I know what it takes to train like that. It doesn't bother me anymore. And I think that was the key for me, is I got to a position where I realized how I need to train to see results.
Yeah.
So anything less was just a bit of a waste of time.
I agree. And I've noticed that. You know, exactly that. I see other people training in the gym and they'll get on Instagram or WhatsApp or whatever and I will look at them and I'll do two sets in between their one. I'm like, you've just lost all the advantage of having your heart rate at where it was.
Yeah.
You're losing all the intensity.
Yeah.
You're actually, why are you even, like, you are not doing yourself any favors. In fact, you probably might injure yourself because now your muscles are cooler again.
Yeah, exactly.
The blood's not where that it should be. You're not giving yourself the best chance, you know. And you're right. No one wants to sit in the stinky gym for hours every day.
No, exactly.
Just get it done. Get in, get out. Make it happen.
And you can do it in half an hour. I mean, listen to us. We're talking like, you know, like we would never have talked like this
never.
A little while ago.
But, you know, and exactly right. Like, if I don't have much time, I've got some kettlebells here at the apartment. If I don't have much time, like, on Monday, I had no time at all, so I just did every minute. I set a timer on my phone. Every minute, I did 20 two-handed kettlebell swings.
Wow.
And every other minute, I did 10 push-ups. So in 20 minutes, I did 200 20-kilogram kettlebell swings and 100 push-ups, and I'm done for the day.
That's amazing.
And the whole day, I was like, you know when you're driving and you hit the indicator, you're like, ooh.
Yeah.
I felt it. And it's good. You get the feeling of like, yeah, I did it. I got it done.
Yeah. But well, I've got this thing called Interval Timer. I think it was a free app. And it's awesome. I think that's one of the big things I learned, is that you just, if you work to a kind of a, you know, the HIIT, the
head
training. If you work to an interval sort of program.
Frankie! Honey, he's licking your dinner. He's licking your lunch. That corner's had dog lick. Yeah. Sorry, if you work to an interval timer?
Yeah, I find like if I work to a little program, like using this little app, you just, I don't know, it's almost like when I don't have my trainer, that this thing is my ass kicking thing. It'll just whip me because it's going. I can't stop that little beep 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 from going off. And if I don't start, I'm only screwing myself. But free app, and then you just sort of write. I don't know. It's fun getting a trainer because now I just write my own little programs.
Tell me about how it changed your doing the work you did, because it was about a year ago now, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Tell me how your relationship to food was before you started that.
Look, it was pretty unhealthy. I feel like I made changes and I lost a bit of weight, and it was pretty noticeable to a lot of people who knew me. I was a bit chubbier, and then suddenly I lost some weight, and you know, I went on the X Factor as a judge, and I of course was looked at it again on TV. So I cut carbs out for the most part, like I did, I stopped sort of eating big pasta meals and rice meals and pizza and things like that. And I did drop some weight, but I hit this wall. I just couldn't get fit, like I couldn't get really fit. And so it's strange. What I thought was a good diet was just an okay diet. It was kind of just a normal diet, but my portions were still big, and it was the little things I didn't notice that would add up. So the nutritionist who was helping me, what she said to me was like, just write down everything that you eat and you'll see how much it adds up. And then I think about my coffees and I used to throw two sugars in my coffee. I'd have four or five a day. So you add that up, you know, you add up a bit of soda here and there, you know, and then even things like sushi train, like how much rice, they're only little small parcels, but then you add that up. So I was doing little bits of cheating here and there, but then in my big meals, I wouldn't have rice with it or something and think, oh yeah, you're doing a great job. But it was the little things that added up for me. Yeah. And when I cut those things out, it made a world of difference. I mean, I saw abs, which I haven't seen since I was a young boy playing AFL. I saw abs in 4 or 5 weeks, and there was a thick layer above those abs. And so whatever those guys did, it worked. You know, it was cutting out all those little cheat meals and those little things, but also tons of cardio mixed with weights. So yeah. I think that combo just smashed the fat off me.
But you mentioned that there was like a more sort of addictive relationship to food.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think for me it was also a I guess it was something I could control in my life. You know, being on tour and you know, having a pretty, I guess, crazy schedule that was ever changing. Food was something that I just, you know, no one could tell me what to do with it. And that's what the big thing was for me I realized how much power it had over me when suddenly I had to rein it in and it was a controlled thing. You know, I had to have control over that. And it was really hard. That was really tough. Like I said, Jules was cool. It was like 2 weeks. She was like, oh, yeah, I'm all right with it. I'm used to it. But, yeah, 5 or 6 weeks it took me. And now it just doesn't have the same sting on me. Like it doesn't have power. I'll see something unhealthy and I'll go, no, I can say no to it now. And I think that when you can overcome little things like that in your life, even if it's just food, it sets you up for the other little battles you have. And same as training, it literally changed my life, you know. And my life has changed a lot since. I've made huge changes in my life and on a career level, on a you know, just on a discipline level, and you know, it very much cleared my head in many ways. And you know, I started the day overcoming things and doing things I thought I wasn't able to do and pushing myself further than I thought I could go. So you start your morning like that, suddenly things that come during the day, they just don't seem as big. You don't procrastinate as much. You can categorize your tasks for the day. I don't know. It lined everything up for me and it also made me way less lazy, I think, in general. And so things that I was probably happy to let go or let someone else control in the past, suddenly that became very irresponsible to me. And I needed to regain – if I could control that, I can control that now. I can control the rest of my life as well, and not in a overthinking, over-analytical way, but just in a responsible way, things that I should have had control of. For a long time I was happy – living a bit in bliss. So it's funny, and I know we've chatted about it personally, just how much effect it has on, you know, on your mind. But the training thing is, it's turned my life around.
So you're just to kind of, you know, make sure I'm hearing you right, like, because I had a similar experience when if you manage to do some resistance training in the morning, and it could just be push-ups, it could just be air squats, it could just be, you know, you going for a walk a little further than you ever would have walked before. Mm. When you've done this thing that you're like, this is a tiny little challenge. All right, I lifted 8 kilos last week. I'm going to do 9 this week. Yeah. This is the tiny little challenge. I've overcome that. the message you've sent to your brain is just push. Just push a little harder. It's only another 10%. And boom, now you're somewhere you've never been.
Yeah.
And then through the rest of the day, your brain goes, it's okay, we'll just push.
Yeah.
We know we did this morning. Yeah. We just do this now. Exactly. Even though now I'm here talking to my accountant, or I'm here talking at the, you know, RTA trying to get my license, or, you know, I'm in, at the Coles trying to wait for a checkout.
Yeah.
You know, just 10% more. And here we are.
Yeah.
So you're saying that just by training your brain to push that little harder to the other side of where you were comfortable, that you now have this kind of different way of operating.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, and not only push, but it's also don't bail. So you know what it's like when you've got these intervals to do and you get to four and you start to feel it and you go, that's enough. That, I mean, I'm sure you think that as well. But in my brain, I'm going, I could stop. Like, that was pretty good. I should just stop. Like, today's not the day. Like, today's not the day. Just four's still good. It's still good. But then something kicks in and says, dude, like, come on. Like, just get to the five. Like, just do it. Just do it. And then you just do it. And then, so you're right. You might be in a meeting or something. And, you know, when you get to that fatigue point and you just, you want it to be over, and we're creative. So we do have shorter attention spans at times. And there's times where I want to bail. I'm like, you know, like today I was telling you I've got to go and put together a whole bunch of tracks and stuff that I'm running for my tour. It's very tedious. It's like, you know, trying to develop a soundscape for that supports the band, doing click track for everyone. It's kind of, it's so boring. And but I know I'll have moments where I've just got to get it done and got to push. And so, yeah, it definitely extends into the rest of your day. It's little victories, but it's also, you know, it's like when I'm right into golf right now, right? So it's all about muscle memory. When you're out in the golf, on the golf course, you'd want to switch your brain off a little bit, because you sort of do, you work on your swing and your driving range, you know, and then when you're in life, you're hoping that the muscle memory will kick in. And so it's these little subliminal things that you're telling yourself in the morning. It kicks in without you even knowing during the day.
Isn't that fascinating that our brains are able to, like, in the same way that the same brain that will only hear the negative thing that we talked about before, in the same way the brain goes, no, it's okay, I know that don't bail and just push that little harder, because when I do, then I get this great feeling.
Yeah.
Then I get this great feeling. So just find that great – what I want is the great feeling.
Yeah.
And to get the great feeling, I just push that 7%, 8% harder, maybe not even 10% harder than I did last time. Oh, here I am. Yeah, look at exactly. us. Now I've got the great feeling.
Yeah. And then after you do that for long enough, then you see the results.
Yeah. But that's the thing. You only, I mean, any mathematician will be able to tell you, if you add, you know, even 5% on top of a result every time, you're like, you turn around after 10 days of doing that, you're like, bloody hell.
Mm.
If I'd done the same thing every day, I'd still be about there.
Yeah. Exactly.
Here I am.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't take much. And I've certainly found that. It's fascinating. I've had a similar experience. And I definitely found it previously in my running career when I, you know, would push a little, oh, okay, 5 minutes, 15, a kilometre. Let's try and get that to 5:10. Let's go a little, let's try and get it under five. Let's try and get it under 4:45. I'm going to run this marathon. I want to run it at like this pace, you know. Just pushing that little harder. And suddenly, like, after a couple of weeks, you're like, oh, here I am. Yeah, this is now comfortable. This is now comfortable. Before, like a month ago, this would have left me on the floor.
Yeah.
But here I am. And this is comfortable. And you find those little reward loops, if you set them up in a positive direction, you know, it's really beneficial, and that it does transfer throughout your day. That's the wildest part, is that outside of the running track or outside of the gym, that there, or outside of the yoga studio, wherever it is that you do it, it's there.
Yeah.
That your brain has that pattern now. Tell me about the discipline and how that changed for you.
Well, you know, as a muso, like, I've always had a good work ethic. As far as, you know, I've been doing it for 15 years now. I've done over 10 albums and I've done, you know, probably 20 tours. I haven't really, I was chatting to Jules about this. We were like, we haven't done the big Europe thing, you know, the trip, or we haven't, like, Jules and I finished school, I did medical radiation at uni, and then that was the thing I quit. And then I went from uni literally to doing those demos, handing it in, didn't work. idle, bang, worked for 15 years. I've had the odd holiday here and there, but never for longer than sort of a week or so, you know, like I've never really taken longer than a week off, maybe until the Christmas just gone. And so it, I'm in this pattern of I had this general work ethic, but very often I would find myself working and working without much of an outcome, or I'd have, you know, it's so many unfinished demos of stuff that should be finished because, you know, potentially these are great songs or, you know, and great ideas, but I move on and my kind of, you know, I procrastinate. And so my work wasn't necessarily focused and, you know, suddenly I, you know, then the training starts and it's, you can't be more focused than you know, having the same, like literally the, every morning, every day I trained for 12 weeks, every single day. And it was so focused and it was so planned. And for me, I saw the results of that. And so that started to translate into my work. So I that discipline I started to take into songwriting. So I identified the things that stop my progress when I'm songwriting. So what's one of the main things? Well, I rely on producing a demo to procrastinate because I'll start fiddling with samples and going through all these sounds and starting to, you know, put together a track for the song I've just written. Now, am I going to use that track? A lot of the times I don't. It's just the demo. I'm probably going to get a producer to do it later anyway, or I'm going to go into a studio and record it properly with proper piano and all this sort of stuff, but I waste this time and I'll spend days making this demo that I never ever really use. And it's just because I know the hardest thing about writing a song is lyrics, you know, like that's the thing that requires the most thought process, and then it's, I've got to labor on that the most. Melody, I can sing melodies for days. So on my phone there's a like thousands and thousands of voice notes of melodies, but then I don't bother finishing the lyrics. So I stopped producing tracks and I just would, the demo that I have now is a voice note of the song and then I move on to another song. So I think that's why in just the last few months I've written almost a whole album, and my last one took 2.5 years and I still wasn't happy with it. Whereas now I feel like I'm writing the best songs I've ever written, and it's just because I've been disciplined enough to identify what the things are that stall my progress. And but yeah, look, the discipline thing, as you know, it was hard. Like when I first met with this trainer, he said, "Mate, we're going to aim for 4 to 5 days a week." And I literally laughed. I was at his house. I said, "Mate, there's no way." I thought you were going to say 2 or 3, like 4 or 5 days a week. There's no way I can do that, you know, with my schedule. I started to make all these excuses and I ended up training every day for the whole 12 weeks. And if I missed a day, I'd work out twice the next day. Literally over that time, I wouldn't have missed one day of training. And I had this goal in mind that I had to do this men's health shoot. And so I don't know, it was so focused and so disciplined. And it was insane the results I got. And people would look at me and be like, "What are you doing? What is, like, what schedule are you on? This is insane." It worked.
So when you were ideal, because there's a lot of people listening, I'm sure they're not, you know, 10 albums in, but they are people who have a process. They are people that are procrastinating. You were able to identify, "Oh, I'm spending all these hours and hours thinking I'm doing work.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, oh, look how busy I am.
Yeah.
Look,
yeah.
I can't talk, can't do with the kids. I'm busy.
Yeah.
I've got to get this tone studio, right. You know? Kick drum sounds. I've got to find the right kick drum before I can move on. Yeah. Got to go. Got to track one kick drum. Got to go. Hours. Dum, 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 dum,
yeah. Dum, 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 bow, bow, bow. Honestly, that is actually what happens. And I sit in with studios and, like, I'll sit in LA, same thing. And you know, someone's like, they're super high and they're like going through their kick drums. They're like, "Oh, this kick drum is so fat, man. This is so fat." And I'll cycle through 1,000 kick drums. And You're right. You're just wasting time.
It's $1,000 now, buddy. Yeah, find exactly. Find one. Yes. Let's go.
Anyone will do. Anything that's, you know, yeah. in that frequency range will work.
But so just to, for people to kind of maybe, you know, get a learning out of this is that you identified, I'm actually not going to use this in the end.
Mm.
What can I use my time? How can I use my time better? Where's the point where I hand this over normally?
Yeah.
This is the raw material I used to hand this over. I'll stop there.
Yeah.
And then I'll spend the time instead doing the thing that I'm afraid of doing, which is writing lyrics.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it's also the realization that I'm only doing this because I enjoy this part. This is like playing the Xbox for me. Like I love putting tracks together and going through my sounds and blah, blah, blah. That's the part I enjoy. So my default is to the part that's easy on my brain and it's me bailing. I'm bailing. And so it's just identifying what stalls your progress. And I did that, I guess, with my songwriting. And I think I've got 9 songs. I've probably only written 16 all up, which is a mind-blowing, you know, sort of...
People might not understand. For an album to have 10 tracks, you might be writing 50 or 60.
Yeah. Easily. Yeah, at least. And so my strike rate's gotten better, you know, everything's sort of lined up. But it's...
So hang on, how do you get yourself to do the thing that you're uncomfortable? How do you get yourself to do the lyric part, which you're like, I'm going to do everything but?
Yeah, discipline. That's it. Just going. But it's that realization. And that's the thing. People just don't think about it. You don't analyze what you're doing. So you think you're being productive, but you're not. And so I think it's important every now and then to just sit back and reflect on, you know, it might be training. You might be thinking, well, what is it? Why can't I get rid of that lower flab or whatever? Like what? Or why, you know, why can't I push past this barrier and I can't get the size that I want or I can't get lean or whatever? And people generally know the answer already in their mind. They know they're not doing enough cardio, or they know they skip leg day or skip whatever parts are uncomfortable. And I think it's really just taking.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Time to analyze what are the bits that I hate and... what are the bits I avoid? Why, like, obviously they're important. I know they're important and I still avoid them. So I'm just going to try and not avoid them. And it's when you're at your most uncomfortable, I think that you see the most breakthroughs.
You see the most growth.
Oh, absolutely.
How do you approach doing the things that you're uncomfortable with?
Like, how do I actually...
Yeah, because like I said, like, people listening will definitely be relayed. They're on board right now. They're like, there's so many things in my life that I'm avoiding. I'm avoiding doing my tax. I'm avoiding getting uniforms together for this week. I'm avoiding doing this 3 loads of laundry. Yeah. Whatever it is that's happening in your life, there's something like, I'm going to do something else. So I feel like I'm busy, but I'm avoiding the thing that I should be, that I know.
Yeah.
As you said, you know the answer.
Yeah.
How do you set yourself up to start those? Like, I'll give you an example. Like, it was a trick I learned years ago with my fitness. Was this when I was about 18. I was about over 110 kilos, right? I was like, I should really go for a walk. But my brain was like, no. It's like, I'm just going to go check the mail. So I walked from my front door to the mailbox. I kept walking.
Yeah.
I ended up walking around the block, which is 600 meters. All right. Yeah. 600 meters was the longest I'd walked in a long time.
Yeah.
Got the mail from the mailbox on the way back up to my front door. Got the mail.
Yeah.
Tricked my brain. I tricked my brain into getting myself to keep going.
Yeah.
You know, so that was how I did it. So how do you do it?
Well, yeah. And as you said, like, it is different for everyone. So I am not great with structure. So again, I analyzed myself and I'm like, well, I don't have a lot of structure in my life, and I don't have a lot of structure in my processes with how I do things creatively, especially. So I introduced structure. And I think that the general rule of thumb is there. It's what I said, like, about being uncomfortable. It's those things that you don't want to do. So try and develop a bit of structure to getting those things done. As you said, it might be the laundry. Well, set aside a certain time in the morning or whatever it is. Like, set aside a little bit of time where you put an alarm on your phone and you put a reminder on, and you force yourself to just do it. And I think it's easier said than done, but the thing you always realize, and everyone comes to this realization, is that it's not as big as you thought it was. It was way bigger in your head. That task was way bigger in your head. And also, I think you have to reward yourself as well. So, you know, with what I do, if I say to myself, well, all right, I'm going to do this, and at the end, I'm going to go for 9 holes of golf, or at the end, I'm going to play the, you know, Call of Duty for a little while and turn my brain off, or, you know, with the training, same thing. Like, yeah, I have gotten really good at rewarding myself by just relaxing a little bit, and, you know, I'm not training for a shoot or anything right now. So go and have some yum cha with my family and, like, reward yourself because I did it that week. But don't reward yourself if you didn't do it. You know, like, it's really simple. I think people are always looking for those easy processes, and the simple answer is it's just not easy. You just have to do it. You just have to. There's no easy answer to it. There's no process except for just doing it, because you will realize it's not as hard as you thought it was, and it's not as bad as you thought it was. Everyone that I speak to always comes to that realization.
That's some extraordinary knowledge that you've just imparted. And it, as you mentioned it, I was just thinking, we think we're smart. We think we're incredible. The guy that drives us electric cars is sending his electric car to Mars. How fucking clever are we? We're lab rats.
Yeah.
Push the thing, the light goes on, the treat comes out.
Yeah.
Push the thing, the light goes on, the treat comes out. Push the thing, the light goes on, no treat. Push the thing, push the thing, push the thing, push the thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're lab rats.
Oh,
we really are. We are that simple. And all we need to do is realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like you mentioned, what's the task? What's the completion of the task? Yeah. What's the reward?
Exactly.
Just do those three things.
Yeah.
Shit gets done.
Exactly. And it's not that hard. It really isn't. It's yeah, I think we do overcomplicate it. And it's funny because people will read, like, I've seen my wife do it. Like, they want to achieve something, so they'll read 3 books about how to achieve it, when really they kind of know how to achieve it already. But people will spend more time on the quest of how to do something when deep down they know they just got to do it. You know?
It's cycling through the kick drum sounds, reading self-help books. And it not is. Doing the work
no.
is cycling through the kick drum sounds.
But convincing yourself that you are doing the work.
Yeah.
So,
I found that in sobriety, I found that there's a big difference between not drinking and being sober.
Yeah.
Like, not drinking is holding on with my fingernails digging into the table through a dinner party with my grit tooth, just trying to get by without drinking alcohol. Yeah. Doing the work, which was figuring out why I would need to alcohol to get through a dinner party, was the tricky and hard part. But once I got that done, I'm not drinking, easy.
Yeah.
Easy. You just got to get the work done. Now tell me, now you've got this discipline around your process, what are the lyrics like? Are you happy with the creativity that you're coming out with?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not big in my head anymore. I'm out the other side now, and I've got processes in place. So, and also I know when I'm stuck, sometimes it's not necessarily because I'm being lazy. Sometimes, as in the creative world, it is a little bit different. Like sometimes it's not like doing laundry, you know. Laundry is going to get done by doing it. Sometimes in the creative world, it's not that simple. So I've also taught myself the process of walking away and, you know, coming back to it. But yeah, look, it's so much better. I just feel like it, I'm not, it's not such a big task and I'm not so insecure about it. And I don't spend the time looking for reasons to not write. Like, you know, one of them being there's so many other people that are better lyricists than me, and they're so much more poetic than me and have such a larger vocab than me. I spend my time now reading and, you know, reading some poetry for inspiration, or looking at certain ways certain songwriters say things. It's so much simpler for me now. I'm not as overcome by the task.
But I love that you've identified, you know, it's interesting. In this conversation, you've mentioned there's the pattern that other people are better. It's like that's the same. Those guys are fitter. Those guys have the look. It's like, okay, that's just a thought. What can I do about it? What control can I have?
Yeah,
I can lift the weight for my poeticism. The lifting the weight is absorbing other poetry, seeing how it works, seeing the rhythms of it, seeing the syllables, seeing how the words craft together, absorbing it, finding inspiration there. That's basically doing the squats for your poetry brain.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then when it comes out, you're like, ah, there it is.
Yeah.
There's the result.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think that's a big part of it is placing that expectation on yourself as well. It's very hard because I see it in my own life. I see it in my wife's life. You know, there's that comparison thing can be quite crippling. And, you know, you can go to certain events or certain things or read books or, you know, whether it be a self-help thing or go to a seminar and you know, or be on Insta and see what people achieve and think, what am I doing with my life? Or think, you know, I'll never do that. And, you know, we forget that a lot of these people were at the same point. And it became about small victories. And, yeah, I don't know. I think comparing yourself is incredibly detrimental. I think you just, yeah, small victories is the biggest key.
And you can't compare your insides to another person's outsides.
No. Yeah, exactly right.
That's really it. That's really, really it. And like, if you want to feel bad about yourself, go and follow a whole bunch of Fitspo models on Instagram and do nothing but look at that for 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
You will want to eat pie.
Yeah. And those people are insecure.
Like, yeah, that's everyone, the thing that people don't understand.
Everyone has. I know a lot of these people and you know, I've met so many people in my life that you would be shocked are super insecure. From people who are the most famous, the most beautiful people in the world, and they have same fears, you know, the same feelings of insignificance, and every time they post something, they're shaking, thinking, what are people going to say? And, you know, no one's got it together. I definitely don't have it together. I said to you as I walked in, I need to get back to, you know, training how I was before, because it only takes a little bit to get back in the mindset of you know, this is, you know, it's becoming bigger and bigger in my head again. So I need to make it smaller again. And you know, I just think it's about, of course, trying to stay disciplined, but also going easy on yourself, rewarding yourself every now and then, and realizing we're all human and we just need to take baby steps, small victories.
Well, that's what any achievement is made up of.
Mm.
I've heard it said that a number one single is 100,000 right decisions.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's 100,000 right decisions.
Yeah.
That's what it takes to be like a US number one, Billboard number one.
Yeah.
You could have gotten wrong at 97,650.
Yeah.
Like gone to the, you know, wrong event, been on the wrong day, you know, you went to the right event, you know, you were Mariah Carey at that party and Tommy Mottola was there.
Oh, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
That's that's how that stuff happens. It's just sometimes if it's in your control, sometimes it's serendipity. But Absolutely. It all is. It's just in the tiny micron level movement. As long as the controller we have is pushing ourselves in that direction constantly.
Yeah.
It might not be a leap that day. It might just be 1 foot in front of me. There might be a toe's distance from where you were yesterday. But as long as you're constantly applying yourself in that direction, you should be all right.
Yeah.
You'll turn around and realize you're in a different place.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's really the thing. So with this discipline, and I'm vibing off how into this you are, man. Tell me about how you've obviously, you've been on tour. You said 22 tours, you said?
20, yeah. I'm sure it's 20.
That's a lot. People may not understand how difficult it is to find that many musicians who are free for that amount of time, line up that many venues, line up merchandise, T-shirts, promo. How do you get 11 people from this place to that place, have them in their hotel rooms, get cars? It's a colossal, colossal effort. Tell me what getting ready for this tour that you're going on in a couple of days. Tell me how getting ready for this tour has been different on a musical level, because ultimately that's what people are paying to see. That's the product people are paying to see, the hour and a half that you're on stage.
Yeah, well, definitely the most nervous I ever get is just before a tour. I don't know why, because I would have thought that would have got easier, but as recent as my last tour, I had the exact same feeling as when I went on my first tour, just that nervous kind of, what are people going to think of this show? Like, are they going to vibe? How's it going to run? Is it going to, you sort of run your show and then you think, is there going to be lull moments where people switch off? And so there's all these thoughts going through my head, and it isn't until the first or second show that I relax. And when I say relax, like, once I know it's a good show, I am probably too chilled. Like, I'll get ready at my hotel, like, and just lob up 5 minutes before stage. Like, I'll warm up, in the car on the way there or something. Like, I am super chilled. But before that, I am insanely nervous. And I think it's a good thing because it makes me really scrutinize the show. As you said, it is tough. It's really hard putting a tour together, especially in Australia.
But tyranny of distance, man. Like, you could to mention not going around Europe, you could go around Europe 5 times by the time you're done with an Australian tour.
I mean, even doing the North Queensland or something run, like, you're going, people think, oh, you're going from Mackay to Townsville or something. That's a long way.
It's a five-hour drive.
Yeah. When you're talking, comparing to US or comparing to Europe or whatever. And it's, it's sort of investing into your show as well. I just had a conversation with an artist that flicked me some tour dates recently and said, this is my first sort of solo tour. What do you think? And my advice to this person was, don't see this as a money-making venture. Like, I toured for 10 years before I saw my first profit. And beyond that, I was either just barely scraping through or losing money. I mean, I lost hundreds of thousands of dollars on tours before, but I set a precedent that I invest into my shows. I just don't take just, to say, a DJ or something and try and make it a money-making venture. I want people to look at that and compare it to international shows that have way bigger budgets, that are doing 100-something shows on their world tour, and go, yeah, we've got great quality acts in Australia. And so I've always taken band members, I've always taken, lighting and production and sound even. I don't use house sound. I'll use sort of, custom, audio equipment and stuff that I know is going to maintain quality throughout the tour. And I think it's those little things. And when you invest in your show, people come back, and eventually it'll be profitable, and it'll be something that, because you've set a precedent. Like, why is Pink so huge? Like, she's such a massive act in Australia, way more than she is even in the US. She doesn't tour in the same capacity as she was here. But Pink is huge because people went to that first show she did, and she was up in the ribbons doing acrobats, and, like, it was such a great quality show. So word spread, and people said, you've got to go see Pink live. She's amazing live. And, I think that's one of the biggest things that I tell people who are touring for the first time. Don't see this as, I want to clean up and make money on tour. invest into your fans, invest into your craft, and try and get these songs on stage framed in a live setting the best you can.
When you are on tour, having been on tour a few times myself, it can be pretty tempting to fall into the, it's an away game, away from home, I have a few beers after the show, you know, the flight's not until 1, I can check out late, you know, I'll eat a room service thing at 2 in the morning, you know, and just generally let yourself, you know, after, I remember because when we did Idol, we would do these audition tours and we'd be away for 6 or 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
3.5 weeks in, I was a wreck, because I'd just been subsiding on minibar cashews and beer, you know, hiding in a hotel room being weird. How do you maintain, a discipline around, because let's not forget, people love you and you came into Australia's heart because you have an extraordinary voice. Physically, the inside of your body from your nostrils down to about your clavicle is very different to other people, and your ability to control it and make it do things that other people can't do is what sets you apart from a lot of other people vocally. Yeah. So that's a very complicated amount of musculature and things to take care of.
Yeah.
Have you found in the past that it was difficult to do that, and how do you deal with it now?
You learn as you go. You realize, and I've had moments where I probably did too many in a row. You know, I've done 5 or 6 shows in a row and I lose my voice by the 4th or 5th show. And I think it's about pacing yourself. But and I'm extremely boring, on the road. I don't drink until the last show, and I don't, I go to bed as soon as I can after the show. It generally takes a while for me to go to sleep, but I'll just force myself. And it's about sleeping as much as I can, trying to get my voice back. It's back to that discipline, because I think the worst feeling professionally that I've ever had is I was in this town called Casino. It was one of my first tours in New South Wales, and I literally completely lost my voice. It wasn't too long after Idol. It was one of my first tours. And I literally couldn't do the show. That was the first time ever, and the only time I've ever really cancelled a show. And I didn't cancel. I still thought I could do it. So I had a doctor come and visit me and inject me full of steroids. And I was pumping vitamin B shots and taking all this stuff and making garlic and ginger, drinks and stuff, and it didn't work. I got on stage and I couldn't sing. And Pauline actually was my support act. And do you remember Peter the pig farmer?
Yeah,
he lived not too far from there, so he came on stage and he helped me out. And we had this jam session. I ended up playing drums for half the gig, and it was I walked away off stage afterwards in tears, because I felt like I had just ripped everyone off so bad because they didn't get the best of me. And so my goal is that every single person who've purchased a ticket, they deserve the best of me, the best of what I do. So the only way I can do that is to look after myself.
So there's stories I want you to tell me that so I'll limit it to two questions. Yeah. Tell me a Eurovision story.
Ah, wow.
you went as Australia's Mauboy was there this year. You went as Australia's entrant, which is fucking the coolest thing ever. Because I think Eurovision is the greatest thing. It's the greatest television thing ever. It's the Olympics of television every year. And if you don't like Eurovision, I don't know if we could be friends.
Hey, look, it was the most fun gig I've ever done in my life. As far as a singular gig, that was hands down the most fun thing I've ever done. A lot of pressure. I think they really drum up the pressure because there's so many run-throughs and rehearsals and stuff that it just makes it such a ginormous thing in your mind. And 200 million people or something watch it. So it's a high-pressure gig. I partied a lot during that time. You know, once I'd finished my performance, it was just Eurovision, you go there and you party. It's a really fun time, and the parties are super positive. And it's you think about Eurovision, it's a continent which has had such a history of conflict and you know, territory, you know, conflict and all sorts of wars, and they come together, and countries that are generally, you know, they generally hate each other, come together, and there's such a unity there, and everyone's, it's so camp and beautiful and fun, and I just loved it. I loved it. It was the most fun gig I've ever done, like ever. But singular story, I can't even think of one. It was just, it was in Vienna my year. I absolutely just had a ball, had a ball. Yeah.
Okay, so tell me then, what did you, I could spend an hour and a half asking you about the next topic, but I'll limit it to one question.
Yeah.
What did you learn from touring with the Booker T and the MGs show?
Oh, well, that was a turnaround in my life. So that was pretty low. I was at a fairly low point in my career, and
for people who don't know, can you basically explain who this band is and why it was important that you toured with them?
Yeah, well, I so that's an example of losing money on tour, but it being an investment into my career. So I grew up on Stax Soul. I liked Motown, but there was something gritty about Stax music.
I'm more a Stax guy.
Yeah, had this kind of, you know,
when STAX, Google that, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, Stax, you know, in Memphis, there was Sun Studios, and there was the Stax, you know, guys as well, and the house band was basically Booker T and the MGs, and so they would get people like Otis Redding through, you know, Sam and Dave, Wilson Pickett, all of these guys would come through and record with this band. You know, Muscle Shoals were the other guys that used to, you know, they did a lot of the Motown stuff and a lot of the more polished stuff, but the Stax band were, they just had this thing. Donald Duck Dunn on bass had just very simple but super melodic lines, and you know, the Memphis horns, just such a grit to it. They didn't have the budget that Motown did or the polish, but it had this soul to it. And, you know, you look at Memphis, from Aretha to so many other people who grew up in that area, it just taught me a lot about how to perform. Otis Redding, Sam Cooke, they were my heroes growing up. And so I always wanted to do something along those lines, but I never in a million years thought I would actually record with that band. And I mentioned I was at a low point in my career. I released a bunch of stuff. It didn't work. There was talks I was going to get dropped from the label, and it was kind of a...
It's almost unthinkable that you'd get dropped.
Oh, but,
so I can only imagine how tough it was behind the scenes that was on the cards.
Well, it was just nothing was working. Like, I tried a bunch of stuff and it just wasn't working. And... you know, there was talks about doing this covers album, and it was this ballads thing, and I love ballads, but this one was like, it was super cheesy. It was
Guy Sebastian ballads, yeah. The perfect Mother's Day gift.
Honestly, and it was that. It was geared towards that. There was Peter Cetera,
I know.
And like Barbara Streisand, People was on the list. All these songs, and I wasn't. They weren't even songs that I kind of like. I love ballads, but they're usually like soul R&B ballads or just, you know, or old school like Chicago or something. But these were just things that was, I don't know. I said I'd rather quit than do this. Like, I don't want to do it, and I'd rather be dropped. I'd rather quit. And if I'm going to do a covers album, it has to be what I feel like I want to do. And so... you know, the idea was thrown around. It originally came from actually my agent, Tony Grace. He had just been to Memphis, and he knows how much I love that music. And he originally was talking about it's like a Sun Studios type vibe where it was Elvis, and it was more of a rock soul thing. And I was like, oh, dude, if I'm doing anything Memphis, it has to be soul. Like, the Stax was just insane. And then my manager at the time, Titus, ran with the idea as well, and then it just came about. And Dennis, you know, like, you take that to your record label.
Dennis is the boss of Sony Music. Dennis, they call him the Don, because he's the godfather. 30
something years, he's
the godfather of the music industry. He really is.
Yeah, but to be honest, I went in there thinking Dennis is not going to. It's not Motown. It's not super pop. A lot of this is kind of the lesser known of the soul stuff. You know, it's Dennis just loved the idea and just championed it from the start. And, you know, that's not me sucking up to the CEO of my label, because, like, I don't need to. We've been through so much together. He has never once said, no, you have to do this to me. Not once in my career, which I'm really grateful for. And he kind of green-lighted the whole thing. I went to Memphis. We recorded this album like it was done back in the day to analog tape. One take. Like, I reckon 85% of the album was one take. There might have been one or two songs where, you know, Dark or someone wasn't happy or whatever, but I had to be on my A game, because, like, the way music's recorded nowadays, no one's doing one take. Like, they'll do 100 takes and comp little words, you know, I like this word from that take and I like this little note from that take and this from that take. And it'll be like a jigsaw puzzle, you know, when you look at a vocal take. But this I had to nail from top to bottom in a performance, you know, and I had the horns playing here. We all recorded in the same room. It was mind-blowing. The gear we used, because I'm just a total gear slut, and so we were using old compressors and, like, microphones, like vintage
big vacuum
gear.
Tubes everywhere.
It was like, I mean, I have a lot of that gear that I've collected over the years, but some of this stuff is like, you know, we're talking $30,000 compressors and,
wow.
And like it was insane. And so we ended up with the Memphis album, and it sold really well for me. And then I wanted to tour it, so I flew the guys out. You know, we opened the show with a warm-up show at the Bridge Hotel in Balmain, and it's a small, gritty little hotel, and just such a great venue to play in. You know, when the band got up there, they were almost 70 years old, these legends, people filed in, it was packed, you know, sold out, and people were standing out the front just to hear these guys play. You know, Donald, you know, couldn't get up on stage. I remember my tour manager and myself just pushing him by his butt, you know, getting him on the stage. And he's like, thank you. And then gets his bass around and then just starts playing. And it was like, you're talking Steve Cropper on guitar, who wrote Midnight Hour, you know, Dock of the Bay. So Knock on Wood, so many other songs that have shaped, you know, soul music. And they're on stage with me. And so the thing that originally was something that I thought was going to be the end of my career, some sort of covers, cheesy ballad album, it ended up being the critically most acclaimed thing I ever did, because here were these guys doing interviews with some of the most music, you know, the kind of the most critical journalists that had been of my career. And there was a lot of people that were quite critical of me, due to being a reality TV winner.
Yeah, they didn't like us very much. They didn't like the fact that we were successful selling records and getting people to buy tickets. They did not like that we'd bucked the system.
Oh, no.
At all.
No. It was a...
They still don't.
No. It's still a weird landscape. But you know, like that thing turned my career around. And like I said, I lost a lot of money on tour, because I had to fly these guys from, you know, from Memphis, Nashville, everywhere in the US, and they weren't cheap, and, you know, it was expensive. I lost a lot of money, but it turned my life around, and it was such a worthwhile investment. And we're talking, shows were sold out. You know, I had Barnsey jump on stage because he wanted so bad to sing with these guys. And obviously Barnsey did a soul album back in the day, you know, and we got up on stage at the State Theatre and sung, I think we sung when Something Is Wrong With My Baby.
All right, man.
And, yeah, it was killer. It was such a moment, and
but those guys were in the interviews. They were vouching for you.
They kept saying, you know, like this dude can sing, you know, because I think it was all one take. They didn't really expect that, so they were very, you know, like they spoke very highly of me to all these guys, and it was almost like some of these journalists were going, are we talking about the same guy? Well, I hate this guy. Like, and there's one in particular, one or two in particular, that hated me. Absolutely. Just, they used to write some of the most nastiest things about me. A lot of stuff that just completely wasn't true as well. And complete backflip, like just 180. From that point, just super, like, positive about everything I did. And, yeah. It was a big turnaround.
I'm grateful that it came, though. It came from you saying no.
Yeah.
It came from you having a healthy boundary. It came from you going, I would rather not do this thing that I love with all of my heart than do that.
Yeah.
That's how much I want to stay true to what I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, look, like I said, I love ballads. I will eventually, I am dying to do ballads type. It will probably be a lot of originals, but my next album is very ballad heavy. Like, it's kind of more Sam Smithy in its approach and much more organic. I'd love belting out a ballad, but I mean, we were talking Barbara Streisand and things. It would have buried me.
Yeah. You're in your mid-20s. Like, yeah, exactly. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Like, give me 30 years, boys.
Yeah.
Maybe then when I could do a duet with an old lady who used to be called Lady Gaga.
Exactly right. Yes.
Maybe so. When people, and, you know, anyone in the public eye, you know, you are out there, people are not always going to say nice things. As you mentioned earlier, in your career, people have, you know, commented on your appearance quite a bit, and they've commented about, you know, the validity of your right to call yourself a recording artist, to call yourself a touring artist, to call yourself a somebody that sells records, you know. But honestly, look, in the words of our friend Grassy, our Shannon Knoll,
yeah,
people vote with their wallets, mate. Yeah. I don't care what they say about me. That's his approach. What's your approach? Has your approach changed when it comes to criticism in the public eye, particularly now that, you know, we open ourselves out to criticism? Every time we post something on Instagram, there's always someone that's going to say,
criticism's always hard. It is. It's, I think, anyone that says it's water off a duck's back is lying. I think when you read things, or, you know, like it frames your mindset and can do so for the whole day or even longer. And so you might read something about yourself or listen to some words in the morning about yourself, and then that's, you react based on what that's done to you, you know. And I think it's hard to brush sometimes, but what's always stuck for me is I always refer to this example on social media where I addressed this person who was just saying some really nasty stuff about me, and I went back to him and said, whatever it was, you don't know me, or blah, 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 right? And I had a fan write to me and said, I swear I've probably written, you know, 1,000 messages to you over the last few years, and all of them saying how much I love you and blah, blah, blah. And it just broke my heart because, like, you've never responded to me yet. This guy says one thing that's, like, vile about you and gets your energy. And I was reading my computer and I started to tear up because I just felt so awful. And she was completely right. Like, we decide what we focus our energy on, and sometimes we neglect the people who are for us in favor of the very small percentage of people who are against us. And I think I just learned a lesson that, you know, if I'm going to pour my energy into anything, like, make it about the people who support me and who are for me. And overall, I have to say I've been extremely fortunate. I don't really have enemies in media. I appreciate the media I wouldn't have a career without them, because I wouldn't be able to flog stuff. I wouldn't be able to promote stuff. And my life has benefited hugely. So if someone writes something, it is what it is. That's their job, you know. And sometimes I probably deserve it, as long as it's within some level of respect or whatever, it's fine. I think journos get called out. You know, we've spoken about some things that were said about you in the past, which was called out, and it was absolutely disgusting and vile. And but like I said, as much as we think it's water off a duck's back, it never is. And so we just need to train ourselves to just concentrate on the positive. There's so many people in our lives that are beautiful that you didn't text that day, you know. So I just try and remind myself, if someone says something, think about the someone who I haven't reached out to, or think about a fan or someone who deserves my energy. And, you know, one day every week I go through the messages now, and with my new management, we'd record videos and messages saying thanks, and little requests like, you know, someone's getting married or someone's birthday, and so I'll do all these videos. And it's really, I don't know, it's really liberating. I'd rather do that than spend one day a week looking at the, you know, shitty things that people are saying about me.
Not everyone is in the public eye like yourself. Not everyone is, you know, opening themselves out to, here's this thing that I've created that I'm proud of. What do you think of it? You know, mm-hmm. whether it be a song or a video or whatever. But everyone will put a photo on Instagram. Everyone put something on Facebook. Everyone is open to criticism through their day. Mm. People will write 10 nice comments, but then there's going to be Dicko.
Yeah.
Terrible look.
I feel bad because I love Dicko.
It's okay. I love him with all my heart. Oh, man, changed my life. Yeah. I love him with all my heart. But, you know, everyone can relate to it's that one.
Yeah, because even Dicko said a lot of positives, but I held on to that one little...
How have you changed the way you look at those things now?
Yeah, look, I think it's just, yeah, they just don't have the same power as they did. You know,
How did you decide they didn't have that power?
I acknowledge that they can have power over me, and so they just don't have the power over me because I just choose to not concentrate on them or look at them. So I do read comments, but if it's negative, if I can even see that it's negative, I kind of just brush over it. But I definitely don't draw attention to it and give energy to it. So that's the difference. Whereas in the past, I might have responded, but now if I do respond to something, it's usually just I'm taking the piss, but I'll then do 4 or 5 responses to someone positive. Mm. To balance it out, yeah.
Not everyone who – and we did 7 seasons of Australian Idol. Mm. We have 7 people come out on top.
Mm.
Not everyone had the same success that you and Shannon did. Where does self-belief play a role in what's kept you going, even through the times when, you know – you were going to get dropped, even through the times where you put out an album, the last album you put out, you said, indeed, you weren't even happy with it. Where does self-belief play a role in keeping you going in that direction?
I think it always comes down to acknowledgement of the power that what I do can have, like the over people. And so acknowledging that, you know, well, I'm not doing it because I want X amount of radio spins, or I'm not doing it because I want it to chart here and there, but it's realigning your brain to acknowledge that, you know, I have an effect on people with my music. So when someone writes to me on social media or writes, you know, sends me a Facebook message saying that song you wrote, it helped me through this time. And then people say it to my face. They say, oh, you know, man, your music really got me through this or that. Or even as simple as, man, I love your music, so fun. Like in the morning, it just lights my day. Or I'll see someone singing my song in the car as it's playing on radio. And you just see the joy that music can bring you. There's an acknowledgement that music isn't just a bunch of notes strung together and a bunch of lyrics written down, but it moves people. It helps people. It's helped me out of so many things. I mean, I also identify music with landmark moments in my life, whether it be, you know, that you know, the song that we danced to at our wedding, or you know, the song that was playing in the delivery room with my kid, or the song I wrote for my son. You know, like it acts as a highlight to so many moments in our lives. And so when I have failure, which is often, it doesn't stop me. I realize it's a numbers game, and that even the failures move people. So I mean, on my last project, I released this song called Candle, and I thought it was one of the coolest things I've done ever. And I love how I remember being in the session, and when we wrote this song, it was a very fast song to come about. I wrote it with John Hume and a friend of mine, Trey, and when the chorus hit, there's this wall of guitar, and it's just fat, distorted, just really it's really thick, and it's a bit shocking. But I remember when they were saying, oh, radio won't play it if there's like that much, it's pretty shocking. But when we dumbed it down, I was like, oh, it just doesn't have the same effect on me. Like, it just doesn't sound right. And anyway, so we kept it and released it, and I just thought, man, there's nothing that sounds like this on radio right now. Like, it's going to be sick. Like, they'll embrace it. No one played it. Absolutely no one played it. And by that stage, it was probably three or four songs in a row that just disappeared out of the 200. No one played it. Then there were seven in a row. There were seven songs that I did that just didn't light up the charts, didn't do anything. And then I released a song called Set in Stone, and that got played and it resonated, and it didn't go number one, but it still resonated, and I think it went number four or something, which is actually really hard to do now in the current climate. The Aussie music is in a very difficult time at the moment. There hasn't been a number one since 2015. We're in 2018 now.
We haven't had an Australian number one since 2015.
No, and it was Veronica's You Ruin Me. It was the last number one. It's extremely difficult at the moment, just with streaming and radio and everything else. There's a lot against, especially pop music. There is a lot of opportunity, weirdly, for indie music. So it's in a great way. It's done a good flip where there's a lot of festivals, and if you're an indie artist, there's a lot of places to get your music out. Funnily though, as a pop act, it's actually pretty difficult now because the landscape's changed. But I didn't give up. You know, I kept going, and I released a song called Bloodstone, and that resonated and got played a lot and had a lot of radio support. And I just keep reminding myself it's a numbers game. Like, and that even the failures have significance. And you know, I was reading an article the other day where I think the intent of the article was a little bit of a negative skew to it. But this is how I guess I've trained my brain now a little bit to do the opposite of what I was talking about before. Instead of just finding the negative bits, the thing I took away from was they said my last album has received a lot of critical acclaim now. And so, you know, it was a bit of an experimental thing for me. It was very production focused, my last album, and I've switched from Logic to Ableton. So the whole process of how I work changed, and I was really heavily into production and used some incredible producers as well. And so I took away from that. I felt like that was such a win because, like, in my mind, it didn't chart and it didn't sell, and it wasn't like a very pop album. It was sort of not really pop at all, except for some moments like Bloodstone. And I just think we just need to realize it in this industry, especially, but in the creative industry, it is a numbers game. Mm. You just keep going.
The thing that keeps you going, you were alluding to it before. It seems to be that the thing that makes you want to get up every day and write another song and not go and, you know, open, you know, I don't know, Guy Sebastian's chicken and waffle restaurant or whatever, you know, yeah, to go into, you know, owning five F45s and that's it, I'm tapping out,
yeah,
you know, to go and, you know, yeah, I do gym, I'll open a gym, you know. Mm-hmm. The thing that keeps you going, from what I just wanted to see if I can, you know, get you to expand on it a bit more, is it that you are able to bring a happiness to another person? Is that what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's that knowledge that it's deeper than even what I think. You know, I know music's deep, and so and it's not me trying to be cheesy or trying to be Oprah or something with my music. It literally is. I mean, I've done tons of tours. I've recorded tons of songs. I still love it and I still enjoy it. But if there wasn't that element where there's a realization that there's more to it than just that, you know, I don't think I would have kept doing it, to be honest, because it is that effect on people that really drives me. And, you know, I mentioned Oprah. I sung for Oprah like a couple of times when she was here, and she talked about that exact thing, right? I sung at her private rap party for her and her staff, and she was dancing with her arm around me and everything, like for an hour and a half. It was awesome. She had her arm around my banner, like just dancing, and everyone's sweaty. Like, it was awesome. But then she got up, and I was like, this is why Oprah is the queen. Because she said she did this speech to all of her staff, and she went through all of the letters and things that people had given, had written through while they were in Australia. And it was all these letters of like, you helped me through this, or you've done this for me, and as a result of you being here, I've blah, blah, blah. And they did a lot of stuff, and they helped a lot of people while they were here. And she was pointing people out in her staff, and she goes, that's not my victory, that's your victory. And you might sit at your desk and think you're just doing your accounts, but you contribute to this greater purpose. And without you, this would all fall over. You're all rungs in the ladder of us being able to climb to this platform where we can affect people. And I think that's sometimes it's just so true. Like, what we need to find that greater purpose in what we do. And sometimes it is literally finding purpose in doing something as small as getting a coffee and saying, I love that dress, to someone, or I love, oh, you know, you look so good in that hat. It pops your eyes. Or, you know, it's moments of kindness and moments in our lives where we can affect people and we can find purpose in our existence. And it just gives us drive. For me, it's how music affects people. For someone else listening, it's, you know, you've got to find it, because we all have purpose in life, and we all have a positive impact, or at least the potential to positively impact others. And I think that's what keeps us all going.
Man, I'm so grateful you came around today.
Thank you. We've waffled, haven't we?
No, this isn't waffle.
2 hours.
I'm just so stoked that you and I have had this chance to chat. I've wanted to have you on the show for a long time, but I think we waited and the moment was bloody right.
Man. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you. I'll see you at the gym.
That was Guy Sebastian. Man, I'm so grateful that he came around, and I'm so grateful that you got a chance to hear that person, because I've known that person for a long time, and I'm so happy that we managed to get a conversation like that on record, because he is a fantastic human, and the way he looks at life is very, very, very special. You can go and see his upcoming tour. It's happening in the next few days. It kicks off. A lot of the shows are sold out, but there's still tickets around. GuySebastian.com. If you did like that conversation, go tag him on Instagram. Let him know. Let him know you heard him here on the show. My guests always get a kick when they hear that. Thank you so much for listening to this show. If this is your first show, I hope you enjoyed it. Please subscribe to the show. Enjoy hunting through the back catalog. By all means, start with some of the names that you know. But you may want to dip your toe into the water and explain some of the names you don't know. Drop me a note. Tell me what you thought. Like I said, I guarantee that you'll hear something that you need to hear each and every episode that you listen to. If you do need me through the week, send Osh your email at gmail.com, or just join up with the Facebook group. I'm there pretty much every day. Thank you to Guy for being on the show today. Legend. Thank you to Hayley Van Spania for producing the show today. Andy Ma with audio production. And Anna Mitra, who's working with me on the videos at the moment. He's doing a cracking job. What is it? It's Sunday night. I'm going to go cook some sweet potato on my George Foreman grill. That's what I'm going to do. Hope whatever you're doing is awesome. Until we speak next time, thank you so much for being here. Take care of yourself. Sleep well. And dream of beautiful things.